Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today it's Midday on the Media. David Folkenflik, the media correspondent for NPR, joins me. President Trump's performance at the Helsinki summit has been denounced as disgraceful, shameful, bizarre, and deeply troubling. And that was just the Republican reaction. Chris Wallace of Fox News garnered high praise for his aggressive questioning of Vladimir Putin, while Trump's supporters decried what they deemed a media meltdown after the president's roundly criticized foreign excursion. The White House is in a defensive crouch this morning. Damage control after the surrender summit will be job one for its new communications chief, former Fox News executive Bill Shine, who's no stranger to controversy himself. These items and more when Midday on the Media starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Today it's Midday on the Media. NPR media correspondent and author David Folkenflik joins me to talk about President Trump's trip to Helsinki. Was it a diplomatic debacle, or as some Fox News hosts said last night, did the media simply go into a meltdown like it always does when it comes to the president? Speaking of Fox, there's a new chief in the White House communications shop who comes from a job at that network. Bill Shine has taken over messaging for Mr. Trump, and his appointment sends a message about the president's disregard for sexual harassment claims. We'll explain that. Sinclair Broadcasting, which has close ties to Fox, has hit a snag in its effort to purchase Tribune Media. Yesterday, the chairman of the FCC voiced serious concerns about the nearly $4 billion deal, which has languished for months. The Sinclair deal isn't the only media merger and conglomeration in the headlines these days. What can we expect might change about the way we access content and the ways producers make that content with big mergers and acquisitions like the Disney and 21st Century Fox deal and the merger of AT&T with Time Warner? And now that Donald Trump has redefined the notion of fake news, a term originally introduced by Jon Stewart in the 1990s, what should we make of Sacha Baron Cohen's latest punking on Showtime? Cohen asks, who is America? Seems like a timely question. We'll talk about these and perhaps other stories on the media beat with a journalist who has been on that beat for nearly 25 years. David Folkenflik joined NPR in 2004 after a decade as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He's also the author of an acclaimed book about Rupert Murdoch called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. He joins us on the line from the studios of NPR in New York. Hey, Dave, good to talk to you.
Mr. Hall, thanks for that generous introduction.
Well, you are more than welcome, and it's always good to have you on the show. So we'll dig deep into this, but your general reaction to the really extraordinary events in Helsinki, Finland yesterday, not just Mr. Trump's remarks, Mr. Putin's countenance, but then the reaction in the media and elsewhere to it.
I think you saw a crystallization of the sense and conclusion and sentiment of many in the press corps that these are exceptional moments and in some ways exceptionally damaging moments, and that the usual vernacular that major senior journalists and the political press corps uses to describe moments of intense interest have been outstripped by the events unfolding in front of them. And therefore, you saw really tough language being used by people on a variety of networks, pointed headlines and coverage in major news organizations online and in print this morning, trying to capture the, this isn't surreal simply anymore. This is deeply troubling, disturbing, disruptive to have the president of the United States essentially offering, hey, on the one hand, all of my, my intelligence officials and the FBI and the Department of Justice say that the Russian government embarked on an intensive campaign to disrupt and interfere with our elections, the very crystallization of our democracy. And on the other hand, Vladimir Putin, an autocratic figure who tries to vanquish political opposition and extinguish dissent in his own country, tells me forcefully that it's not true. And I think that that, you know, the reason that you heard such an intense reaction from news organizations that do not consider themselves to be partisan was not because they're trying to put their thumbs on the scale, but because of the extraordinary nature of what we've seen. And I think that you haven't seen anything like that since the Charlottesville protests last year, where you had essentially neo-Nazis, American Nazis, and white supremacists, racists, protesting. You had people counter-protesting, and you know, white supremacist zealot, you know, drove into the protesters, killing a person, injuring others, and the president essentially saying, "Well, you have good people on both sides, and you have, you know, troublemakers on both sides," as though those are two equal camps to be assessed.
Yeah, again, this notion of equivalency. In Charlottesville and again in Helsinki between Russian contentions about what they didn't do in the elections in America in 2016 and the Intelligence Committee's overwhelming conclusion about what they did do. I wonder, Mr. Trump is, if nothing else, a line crosser. We've been talking about how Trump crosses the line from the day he announced his campaign in 2015. Do you have a sense now in the very early hours of the reaction to this particular event in Finland that somehow the outrage about this will be sustained in a way that it really hasn't been sustained after Charlottesville? It hasn't been sustained after news of paying off a porn star came to light. There have just been so many occasions in which Mr. Trump has outraged various people for various reasons, and it all seems to fade into the ether world at some point. I mean, Mr. Trump was tweeting this morning about how great the economy is doing.
You know, I don't think this will fade instantaneously. I think it's disruptive, and I think you're watching figures in the national security establishment and on Capitol Hill, and as a result, in journalism, still trying to absorb what is essentially, you know, a blow to the body politic. But I also think that in some ways, the real locus of power is to be found with congressional Republicans. You know, the president's party controls both chambers of Congress at the moment, somewhat narrowly on the Senate side, a little bit more on the House side. And, you know, those are certainly on the House side seems to be very much in play this fall. We'll see how that plays out. But right now, you know, you've got to wonder whether, you know, despite all the outrage and all the concern and all the angst and all the vehement disagreement being voiced by congressional leaders and by, you know, various committee chairs and various senior figures, even on the Republican side in Capitol Hill, if they don't do anything about it, then it fades away as an issue because the Democrats have the ability to complain about it, but they don't have the ability to force a reckoning on this. So, you know, what you're going to have to really wonder is whether or not there are, you think of Ben Sasse, the senator, I believe, from Nebraska, or Jeff Flake, who's retiring, the senator from Arizona, Bob Corker, also retiring, senator from Tennessee. They've made extremely strong statements, as has John McCain, who seems to be in very much the twilight, not only of his career, but his life. Are the senators, particularly other than McCain, who's not well enough to be in Washington, are they going to actually take action to hold the president accountable for this? If so, then that is going to fuel a media frenzy that even probably outstrips some of the coverage we've seen of the Mueller investigation and of some of the indictments that have recently been announced by the Justice Department. But the press, you know, it's very hard for the press to sustain attention and outrage, a sense of outrage on its own for long terms. You know, just if you watch it as a student of it, you know, it needs some events and some reaction and some other players to participate.
Yeah, I mean, once again, the media has tried to call out Republicans for not criticizing the president enough. Again, the folks you mentioned are, as you say, Senator McCain in the twilight of his career and perhaps his life, and the others retiring from the Senate. The ones who are still in public office, even Paul Ryan, who is himself retiring, had
That's
a pretty mild milquetoast reaction to it. Mitch McConnell refused to directly criticize the president and simply said, I believe what the intelligence community has said. So again, it's very measured. There seems to be no indication, as far as I can tell, that the Senate is willing to step up now the way they weren't willing to step up after Charlottesville or after some of these other outrageous things. And it also assumes some consensus that the president was wrong in his approach, his countenance, and his actual remarks with Vladimir Putin in the press conference that followed their meeting. Because there's his so-called base, the folks that we hear him playing to all of the time. Is there any reason to understand or to know that the base disagrees with what the president did yesterday? They haven't disagreed with almost anything he's done so far. And if there is no consensus among, and if there isn't really a chipping away of his public support based on his actions yesterday, this just becomes a non-starter. It just becomes like every other scandal that we've had.
Well, I think we're going to see in coming days whether, you know, the degree to which people lead on this, the degree to which that support erodes. I'm sure this, among many other things, will be polled, as such things are. You see the terrific political journalist Bob Costa of The Washington Post just tweeted out a minute or two ago that Bob Corker told reporters that he wants cabinet members to stay in their jobs at the moment to try to help guide the president's thinking. He said, why would we want to encourage Mathis, that's the defense secretary, or Coates, the head of the national intelligence, to leave? That's in response to questions about whether cabinet members should quit if they disagree with the president. On the other hand, you know, certain high-profile resignations at key moments, for example, in the Nixon administration, helped to underscore the idea that this wasn't merely about partisan debate and that there were certain sort of superseding principles at stake and lines being crossed that were not simply, you know, transgressions that we find that many of the president's supporters will forgive because it's just Trump being Trump. I do think that one way to look at this is to watch the coverage on Fox News. And you've seen Fox News corporately be very proud of a lot of the criticisms that have surfaced from some of Fox's hosts. You've seen Neil Cavuto be pretty strong on this stuff. You've seen you know, some more mild criticism, but real criticism from some of their other hosts. Abby Huntsman, one of the hosts of Fox and Friends, said on Twitter, you know, the president of the United States should not throw his nation under the bus. That was notable in two ways, for two reasons from my standpoint, one of which is she is the daughter of Trump's ambassador to Russia. That's John Huntsman, who has been dead silent on what happened between the leader of the country that he represents and the leader of the country where he represents it. The other thing that's noticeable about it is she was much more mild in her criticism when she appeared on the air this morning. She was mildly critical. And I think on the big shows of Fox, on Fox and Friends, and particularly in the evening, Sean Hannity did an exceptionally gentle interview with Trump and Tucker Carlson
has one tonight, which he previewed last night, and it was a question about immigration.
Well, and Tucker last night, Tucker is a very smart, funny, capable guy who agrees with the president on immigration and disagrees on other things, more libertarian figure than Trump is. But, you know, Trump, he plays a lot of defense for Trump, and it's a way of sustaining the Fox viewer. What does he do? He goes after Fox's critics. So Trump mentioned the question of the server that Hillary Clinton used off the books as Secretary of State, or, you know, he's going back and relitigating some of the claims he made during the debates of the 2016 election. She wasn't on the stage. You know, she's not under investigation at this point, and that has nothing to do with what Russia did, unless he's trying to simply confuse viewers and American voters and citizens about what's at stake with the Russia hacks of the Democrats, or if he doesn't understand them himself. But the amazing thing is that Tucker Carlson spent a fair degree of time saying last night things like, am I supposed to not be able to ask about that? Suddenly, is the server off limits? Sure, you can have trouble, you know, take issue with what he said in Russia, but and somehow as an American citizen, am I enjoined against doing that? And, you know, this is unpacking that question is perhaps one of the least useful things you can do at the moment. You want to deal with some of the hyperbole that you think resulted from the president's performance in Helsinki and prior to that, you know, at the UK and at the NATO summit and the like. That's fair game. But the first thing we got to do is figure out what the president did and what it means for the nation, what it means for our relationship with allies, with competitors, with foes, what it does to our standing in the world. And, you know, these are first order of concerns that the press needs to be dealing with at the moment.
I watched a bit of Tucker Carlson and Mr. Hannity's program last night, and there was a couple of crawls that caught my eye during Tucker Carlson's show. One of them said CNN considers Trump impeachment after summit. The other was media in meltdown after summit. And Carlson, at least for a good chunk of what I saw, said, you know, the media has gone crazy about this and I don't understand it. He himself said more than once, he said, I'm agnostic about Russia. Implying that China is the bigger problem. We should mention that today is the fourth year anniversary of the shooting down of a Malaysia Airlines flight, which killed 200 and something people, 283 passengers near Ukraine. And it's largely assumed or understood that Russia was behind the murder of those 283 people. So Mr. Carlson allowed himself to be agnostic about stuff like that. And his focus seemed to be how the rest of the media was going crazy, and he couldn't quite understand it.
Sure. Well, the resting disbelief face that Tucker affects on air enables him to ask a lot of incredulous questions about the president's critics rather than having to wholeheartedly defend the president's positions, many of which he might not otherwise support. And why does he do that? Well, he does a very highly rated show at 8 p.m., five nights a week on the nation's leading cable network, which sustains those ratings by actually broadcasting sort of during its peak hours a fairly concentrated dose of material that the Fox viewer most wants to see, which happens to coincide neatly much of the time with what a Trump voter wants to see. You know, one of the things about cable, and, you know, we talk about Fox's reach, and it is influential, and it does reach a lot of people, but it is the largest niche that it can figure out how to be. And it does that by offering at times uncomplicated narratives designed to appeal to extremely loyal viewers, who in this case often happen to be extremely core supporters of the president. But one of the things that's different about this week in the coverage is that both figures in the media and figures in politics and public life and national security and the like are reacting with strong dismay about this, who are not themselves necessarily strident anti-Trump figures.
It might sustain on the animation of that alone. We're a quick break, so I want you to hold that thought. We'll come back and talk more about this. David Folkenflik covers media for NPR. He's also the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. We'll have more of Midday on the Media with David Folkenflik when we return from a quick break. To join our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our broadcast, another in a series of conversations with the candidates. Anjali Reed Fukan is a certified public accountant who's currently an auditor for the state of Maryland. She's a Republican, and she's running against Democratic State Comptroller Peter Francho in the November election. So we'll talk to her here in Studio A. Plus, I'll talk to Alicia Garza. She's one of the founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, about an initiative that she has to increase voter engagement in communities of color. It's called Black Futures Lab. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday on the Media. My guest is David Folkenflik, who covers media for NPR. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR, to send us a tweet. If you want to follow me on Twitter, @TomHallWYPR. So, Dave, I cut you off when we had to go to a break there. Do you want to finish a thought about the differing nature this time around from some of the other scandals that Mr. Trump's been involved with, given the kind of people, it's not just in conservative media, but the kind of people who are speaking out against the president's actions yesterday?
Well, or not speaking up to defend him. If you saw CNN yesterday, I believe they had booked a former NSC aide under the Trump administration named Mike Anton.
Yeah, on Aaron Burnett's show, right.
Yeah, and he had famously written this memo about Flight 93 and the attacks on our country on September 2001, and was seen as a strong nationalist, sort of American first supporter of the president. He pulled out of the appearance on CNN saying he couldn't support what the president did in Helsinki and couldn't speak up to defend him. There was just, you have anchors like Jake Tapper who can be tough on the administration, but also at times could be tough on other administrations, perhaps not equally because perhaps there's not symmetrical degree of scandal and problematic behavior that's worthy of it, but nonetheless sort of tries to be a guy who rises to the occasion, clearly just overwhelmed by the moment, speaking with real intensity and force and trying to set out for viewers the nature of what had just happened in front of them. I mean, the idea that this should somehow happen unmediated, that the responsible thing for the press to do is simply to relay what the president said and move on, is just belied by the audaciousness of the facts in front of us. And by audacious, I mean, truly, I just want to underscore this. This is not precedented, and it's not precedented in a way that's deeply troubling, and it affects the trust that I think a lot of the men and women who work in national security and in trying to fight harm to the country may feel in the commander-in-chief currently. This is, this is something that could roil into a crisis for the president, and for the press to let that go unnoted, unremarked upon, or treated as just another controversial, colorful moment, I think would be to miss the mission of what they're supposed to do.
And so no longer is it up to the media to simply relay what the president says and let people draw their own conclusions. I mean, last night, Anderson Cooper, when he opened his show at 8 o'clock, had clear disdain for what the president had said and how the event in Helsinki had gone. And, of course, the Helsinki event blew out of the water the great discouragement that a lot of people felt after his trip to Britain and his trip to the NATO summit or the NATO meeting in Brussels. I mean, one story just seems to displace the next every day. I mean, are we done with the days of saying, this is what he did? We're clearly done in a lot of ways with, just broadcasting the Trump rallies sort of, unfiltered and uncommented upon. I noticed that MSNBC, CNN are no longer broadcasting those. I guess Fox still does. But
that's right.
The challenge of covering this president whose disdain for the truth is so so highly documented, it's difficult when he is given no filter at all, because clearly a filter is needed if we are to discern what is actually, where the verisimilitude lies.
Yeah, look, for folks who are part of a national security world, for folks who are on either side who, want responsible stewardship of the government, whatever the policies may be, there are times, particularly in the last week, where, I think of the Paul Simon line, miracles and wonders, this is, horrors and affronts. This has just been one percussive blow after another to the sense of the idea that America is engaging in responsible leadership globally. And that's not a partisan position. I mean, you saw Richard Burr, one of the figures who oversees intelligence and certain other kinds of national security issues up on the Senate side, a Republican from North Carolina, simply saying this morning to reporters, I don't know if it's changed in the last hour or so, but saying, I'm not going to engage with the press today. I'm not going to talk about it. He had put out a statement essentially disagreeing with virtually everything the president said in his presentation yesterday with Vladimir Putin. This is just people are trying to get their bearings about how to deal with this. And what we have seen in previous times is that Republicans have at times been willing to summon rhetoric, but not pretty much anything in the way of action in dealing with this. You saw a number of Republicans tell Axios this morning, hey, look at all these things that we passed. We passed tough sanctions on Russia, which is true. We've done these other things involving with Russia. We passed a series of sentiments of the Congress and of the body to make clear where we stand on Russia, and therefore, what the heck do you want from us? But the reality is that the president isn't going to be hemmed in unless he's hemmed in a broader sense by Congress, which is led by Republicans on both sides, in a broader sense on his authority, on his powers and his policies that will have to supersede any one issue. This just is a moment that you're seeing the press wrestle with how to address something as broad as what they've just seen in terms of the seeming untangling of the understanding we have of how America is going to be led.
David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR News and apparently an aspiring songwriter. You can join our conversation at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Dave, let's go to the phones and talk to Don in Parkville. Dave, or Don, rather, welcome to Midday with David Folkenflik.
Thank you. When Trump announced back in 2015, and I said to friends, I'm more concerned about how many people find him appealing than what he actually says or proposes and so on. And that connects to where I find the role of media of great concern, because in listening to his supporters, the truth doesn't matter. Now, what do you do, what do you provide when to people who support him, the truth doesn't matter, because what I think most matters to his supporters is that they hold the reins of government, that the opposing party, meaning Democrats, are considered evil and cannot be allowed to govern, and it's only suitable for them to be able to govern, and consequently, anything that Trump and, frankly, his party does is acceptable because they're the ones in control.
Thanks for that comment, Don. I appreciate it. And Dave Folkenflik, last night on Tucker Carlson's program on Fox, a guy named Stephen Cohen, who's some sort of historian from NYU, reminded people that Russia and the U.S. were allies during the Second World War. And he asked why people disliked Putin, why they would dislike Putin more than any other Soviet leaders, and how it's dangerous not to let the president of the United States keep the country safe. Do you think those arguments are convincing and persuasive to this mythic base of Donald Trump?
I think those arguments serve to reassure Trump fans that there's a logic to it, that in some ways Trump is not a purely hostile actor, that maybe he has grander visions than he's being given credit for. Even if people don't believe in what he's saying specifically, there's a soothing nature to it, a reassurance. And let's be clear, Tucker Carlson at that moment in sort of going after the president's critics is interviewing a scholar, Stephen Cohen from Princeton, who, if memory serves, is a significantly left-of-center figure, frequently found in the pages of The Nation, who is something of a Russophile and used to be a huge critic of the Cold War under such Republican heroes as Ronald Reagan, among others, and who in this instance is offering from the significant left some cover for the idea that, well, whatever you think of Trump, he's perhaps draining the tensions between two of the remaining global superpowers, certainly nuclear superpowers, and isn't that a good thing? And the funny thing is that you're seeing from people who might have had significant criticisms if a President Clinton, either Clinton, or if Barack Obama or other Democrats had gone and met with Vladimir Putin and been less than confrontational. You know, they're saying now, look, it is a good thing to meet with people, even people that you disagree with, even people who are pose certain kinds of perils to the U.S. What's not good is to essentially deem them credible and to dismiss any concerns against them as not valid simply because they are taking the trouble to meet with you. And what is not good is dismissing the conclusions of your own Justice Department, your own FBI, your own intelligence chiefs, your own Congress, even the Congress led by your own party, simply because you want to somehow feel that you're a leader on the world stage being praised by another leader, however autocratic he may be.
Yeah, so, and people railed against Obama's apology tours on some of his foreign excursions, and there's certainly a whole lot of apologizing going on yesterday from Donald Trump, but it seems to be a different situation in the minds of his supporters. Let me ask you, there are it seems to be three explanations for why Mr. Trump holds the particular posture against or concerning Russia that he holds. The first is that they have some sort of compromat on him. They've got information that would be embarrassing to him, and that they can use him essentially. They can use it to essentially to blackmail him. The second is that his vanity. He would not want to think that the Russians influenced an election, which would in any way attenuate the credibility of his victory. And the third is it's a bromance. He just simply is enamored of Vladimir Putin, who he thinks is a strong guy. Are there other explanations out there in the ether that can explain why the president is doing something that so few people think is a good idea? And what is the media's obligation when it comes to providing context and trying to explain possible reasons for the president's particular countenance?
Well, think of this like a huge Sunday brunch buffet. I don't think you have to choose just one option here. I think that the president may not fully understand the degree to which he's being taken advantage of. I think the president may feel, you know, I'm sort of being perceived as being in bed with these guys. I might as well go all in. I think the president appears, you know, it's hard to get in somebody's head. It's hard to know. But you've seen reporting that strongly suggests that the president does not want to accept the idea that in any way that his victory in November of 2016, which, as we have to remember, included a loss in the popular vote, that it in any way was affected by the actions taken by people working on behalf of the Russian government to disrupt and affect this election. And so, therefore, he's all in on the idea that the Russians are responsible for nothing, because he doesn't want to, you know, suggest that any vote could have in any way been affected, probably not just in you know, the three or four key swing states that he managed to win, but in the rest of the country as well. It is a proposition that almost no one outside the Trump administration credits. There is just, you know, seemingly a growing and insurmountable degree of evidence reviewed by a variety of agencies and public officials that don't just hint at it but scream it. The Republican involvement, and, you know, call it meddling, as you find people who are often allied with the president's do, is to, I think, understate what we're talking about. We're talking about interference in an election, which is, you know, it is not hyperbole to say is the fundamental bedrock and expression of democracy.
Yeah, and of course,
this is a big assault, and to dismiss it, you know, at the lectern next to the guy who is responsible for having it done it and commissioned it. You know, is just
it is remarkable.
It defies parallel.
It does defy parallel. And of course, this happens 3 days after Robert Mueller indicts 12 Soviet or Russian rather intelligence officers for their activities with the Democratic National Committee and John Podesta's emails and WikiLeaks, etc. And it happened the day that an assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, he's the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, indicted a woman named Maria Butina, 29-year-old Russian citizen who lives in Washington, for her efforts to infiltrate the National Rifle Association and various media outlets and work on behalf of the Russian government. Before we take a break, let's go to Blima in Owings Mills. Blima, welcome to Midday with Dave Folkenflik from NPR.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. As a former communist country resident, I was born and raised in Poland. I find his comments about America responsible for the relations between us and Russia absolutely appalling. Former KGB agent, and Mr. Trump is looking up to him. He must be the most insecure president we ever had, the one with the least knowledge of history ever.
Well, thanks for that comment.
It's an insult to all the immigrants that came here and suffered under the communist regime.
Well, thank you for that comment, Blima. I appreciate it. And again, one's perspective certainly colors one's understanding of any event. But when it comes to, Dave Folkenflik, when it comes to the media's handling of this, you know, the obligation to report and the obligation to be to be reasonable about it, it's difficult to sustain that. I mean, last night on Tucker Carlson again, there's another guy named Stephen Cohen who tweeted, I guess he's a member of Congress. He sent out a tweet that said, "Where are the military? The commander-in-chief is in the hands of the enemy." And Tucker Carlson took that tweet to mean that he was calling for a military coup against the government of the United States. I mean, that seemed to be a pretty big stretch for me, at least.
Yeah, I think I hadn't seen that tweet, but he's a congressman from Tennessee, that Steve Cohen, you've seen a number of members of Congress, particularly on the Democratic side, ramp up the rhetoric to try to get attention, as though they're collectively trying to grab the lapels of the American public and shake them. I think they're doing it with an eye toward the elections, but I don't think this is merely partisan posturing. I think people are genuinely concerned about what a presidency does that is uninhibited and untrammeled. A number of congressional leaders, as you know, you and others have been talking about, seemingly have struck a deal with themselves that they're willing to tolerate a lot from the president in exchange for some key things like the tax bill
cuts,
that
court nominees,
the House Speaker Paul's Ryan got through, and as you say, the Supreme Court nominees. And you know, these are moments, things like Charlottesville, a little bit things like the endorsement of Roy Moore in Alabama. Which the president said he kind of later regretted, I think. And these are moments at which people are questioning that degree of support. And you're seeing in the press a reflection of that unease that is being voiced to reporters. You know, reporters aren't making this stuff up. People in Congress, people in the military, people in the national security agencies and departments, people even in the White House are deeply disturbed at what they're seeing. And yet, you know, there was one headline that said this didn't go according to plan. I think it was
the Washington Post, Dolly Lennox. Yeah, they gave him a 100-page briefing booklet about what he should say, and he said none of it. So we'll talk a bit about the messaging and the new hire at the White House in terms of their communications staff. Bill Shine from Fox News is now taking the position that Hope Hicks held for quite a while. We'll do that when we come back from a break. David Folkenflik is the media correspondent for NPR News. He's on the line from NPR in New York. More of Midday on the Media when we come back. 410-662-8780 to send us an email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's Midday on the Media. We are spending the hour today with David Folkenflik, who covers media for NPR News. His latest book is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empire. He's also the editor of Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email to midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So, Dave Folkenflik, you filed a story for NPR a few days ago about Bill Shine, who's the new communications head at the White House. He's got strong ties to Fox News, worked closely with Roger Ailes, and also with Sean Hannity, who appears to be a frequent communicator with the president. There are some reports that they speak almost nightly about matters large and small. What can you tell us about Mr. Shine, and what do you think that means in terms of the White House's approach to communications moving forward?
Bill Shine joined Fox News at its outset. He had been a producer basically in talk radio. And he met Sean Hannity because Hannity had been a radio host, I believe, in Atlanta just before that, and had frequently called into Shine's wife's radio show as a guest. And the two of them became very close friends. Shine rose to be essentially the head of programming at Fox News, which meant that he was on the opinion side, never a journalist, but a guy who was seen as a decent programmer. And that is, as one anchor put it to me last week, he could, because he was able to review ratings minute by minute, he could discern precisely what personalities, what policies, what subjects, and what takes would turn on a Fox viewer, that is, get him or her to to stay you know, glued to the TV set on that channel. And he also knew exactly what would turn them off. And this is one of the key things that he's bringing into the White House, as this former Fox anchor put it to me, is the ability to figure out what the base is going to be excited by and what they're going to be alienated by. Shine, you know, there are two ways in which it's just extraordinary. He's named as the head of communications, but his title is Deputy White House Chief of Staff. And the idea is that he gets to have an eye slightly greater than simply just the communications division. This was the same role that Karl Rove held, once called President George W. Bush's brain, during the Bush administration, which gives you a sense of the seniority of it. And there are people at Fox who think he may well ultimately ascend to the White House if and when Trump forces Chief of Staff John Kelly out. That is, that Shine could ascend to be the Chief of Staff, an extraordinary position. And here's two reasons why that's so extraordinary. One of which is he's a television programmer. And he rose to be the co-president of Fox News under Roger Ailes, but really in replacing Roger Ailes when Ailes was expelled. And I'll get to that in a moment. But it means that he oversaw these opinionators. And the opinion figures at Fox are the ones that get the ratings. They're the ones that really drive the profits. And they're also the ones that, by and large, have taken the kinds of positions that have been so divisive and at times deeply offensive. You know, he's the person who oversaw some of the stuff that was deeply troubling from Sean Hannity, from Bill O'Reilly, from Laura Ingraham and others. And so that's who he is. Fox has a history of promoting folks who say racially divisive things, things that even have been called outright racist, stoking anger towards people, stoking the Benghazi story, giving enormous airplay to the Benghazi lies, stoking conspiracy theories that are completely groundless against the death of the former Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich a couple years ago, and for which Fox never apologized, and for which Sean Hannity, who gave a lot of time to that, never apologized. So that's who Bill Shine is in terms of his work at Fox.
And then, before you sure. talk about his, can we then expect that he's going to, you know, that he's this master of understanding what pushes people's buttons, this capacity to discern minute by minute ratings? Does this mean that we're going to have just further division? In other words, he's going to figure out what pushes the buttons just of the base that currently supports Mr. Trump and do nothing to expand that base, do nothing to bring others into the fold?
Well, that's a very acute question, because it goes back to something we talked about a bit earlier in the show, which is the idea of cable. You know, Fox is a giant, but it is the most giant small niche you can imagine. It is not looking to broadcast to the nation. It's looking to capture a certain subset of it. And that appears to be the Trump approach. On the other hand, it's hard to be completely shocked by this when we used to have Steve Bannon, you know, as the president's chief strategist inside the White House, as well as his campaign CEO.
Bannon was,
if anything, more divisive when he was the head of Breitbart Media. But this is who Bill Shine is. The second half of the equation, though, I think we cannot forget, which is that Bill Shine was ultimately forced out of Fox News last year because of the sexual harassment scandal that really seized the institution of Fox News, that ultimately led to the ouster of not just Roger Ailes, its propulsive force and the chairman of the network, but its biggest star, Bill O'Reilly, among others. And Bill Shine was not himself accused in a significant way of sexual harassment. What did happen, though, was that he was accused of facilitating and abetting the harassment, ignoring complaints, deflecting them, hammering them down. In one case, he was accused of he was part of essentially an approval of a $3 million payment in 2011 to a longtime Fox employee who alleged that Ailes had extorted sex from her over a period of years, and Shine's involvement in part included by the admission of the network advising her to see a specific psychiatrist back in Texas where her parents lived. So he was involved in handling her after she had made these allegations through Fox officials. He and the network's chief lawyer said that at the time they believed those allegations to be untrue. Those allegations took on a very different cast after other women came forward in 2016.
And in the lawsuits in which he's named, do those continue? Are those over? Have they all been settled? Or is he currently the subject of lawsuits from former employees at Fox?
You know, I'd have to go back. If memory serves, though, there were at least two lawsuits that in which it was claimed that not only had he engaged in this behavior to protect Ailes, but that he had engaged in retaliation against them after Ailes even left the network. And that is that the defense that, well, you know, look, this was the guy at the top and we were doing what he told us to do, or we didn't have the information or whatever, that defense didn't hold anymore, but that he still continued to retaliate against them, a claim that through Fox's attorneys he has denied. One of those cases has been settled for an undisclosed six-figure sum. Another of those cases was referred to binding arbitration, and I'm not certain that that has been resolved yet, as that is a confidential process.
We have an email from Susan who says, I'm very concerned that one of the central aims of this president seems to be to make all citizens of this country distrust everything and everyone, and to keep us all in a state of shock and confusion. I am weary of it, Susan writes. It sounds like Bill Shine is not one who's necessarily adverse to shock and confusion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were reports that Shine and Hannity were conferring with the president during the weekend. You know, the president, in naming Bill Shine, has just brought in-house somebody who had served as an advisor when he was out of office. To be fair, Roger Ailes, when he was running Fox, was an advisor to Donald Trump's campaign, conferring repeatedly and giving him advice throughout. In some ways, the president's communications director is really Sean Hannity, the guy still drawing a paycheck from Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, and a guy who's still getting couple million viewers a night. But Bill Shine is part of that triumvirate, the bromance you mentioned earlier in a slightly different context. They are essentially supporting figures for this president. Bill Shine now off the air, doing so from the White House, and Sean Hannity on the air, doing so from Fox News.
So, Dave, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to ask you about a story that's big in this market, Sinclair Broadcasting, and their about year-long attempt to purchase Tribune Media. We talked about this a year ago. If this purchase goes through, they would have an amazing reach. They'd own 223 TV stations, 108 different markets, some 70%+ penetration into U.S. households. The FCC, under the Trump administration, has voiced concerns about this. They continue to slow it. The stock price of Sinclair took a big dive yesterday, and people are now talking about how this thing may not happen. I wonder, is Fox involved in this at all, and given the fact that Sinclair, with 200+ stations, could become some sort of serious competitor to Fox on the conservative side of the broadcast media? And do you think this plays into the Trump administration's reluctance to approve the merger or to approve the sale?
Well, and of course, the Federal Communications Commission is supposed to be an independent agency. But it's certainly a Trump-friendly chairman at the top of it, in Ajit Pai. You know, that is a fascinating scenario that you set out. I don't have any reporting to bolster it. I will say that Sinclair quietly has built this enormous local TV empire, more than 190 stations it operates and owns and or owns, and was looking to add about 42 more from Tribune as part of the deal. It was supposed to divest a couple of those stations, sell them off. But in a couple instances, the companies to which they were to sell them, Pi notes, have exceptionally close ties to the Sinclairs, to the Sinclairs controlling family, and that's the Smith brothers there in Baltimore County. And the question is whether there was some deceit about whether the Smiths and Sinclair would continue to control them. You know, Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, essentially greased the skids for this deal to happen by undoing some regulations that have been in place for some years in terms of how you judge market control and reach in the country.
Now he seems to be putting the skids on it. Yeah,
he seems to be doing that, but he's doing it at a time he's under investigation by an inspector general at the FCC for how he did that and whether he was too close. Yeah. So he may be feeling the heat himself.
Indeed. Well, we have to put the skids on this program. Dave Folkenflik, I really appreciate your time. As always, it's a fascinating conversation. So thanks very much, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
You bet.
David Folkenflik is the media correspondent for NPR News. He's the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empire, and the editor of Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. Before we go, a look ahead to our next live remote broadcast on Tuesday, July 31st. We'll be in Chestertown at the historic Sumner Hall. It's one of only two existing African-American Civil War veterans buildings in the country. We're going to be broadcasting midday live from Sumner Hall. We'll talk about healthcare access on the Eastern Shore, the challenges that schools face in Kent County as enrollment shrinks, and we'll hear from a member of the Kent County Historical Society about Legacy Day and the rich tradition of African Americans in Chestertown. So that's coming up 2 weeks from today, Tuesday, July 31st at noon, and we hope that some of our listeners in Chestertown will be able to join us for Midday Live from Chestertown. We also hope you can join us when we're back with Midday tomorrow. Anjali Reed Fukan joins me. She's the Republican candidate for Maryland Comptroller. I'll speak to her as part of our Conversations with the Candidates series. Plus, Alicia Garza, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, is also behind the Black Futures Lab. That's an initiative designed to increase voter engagement among people of color. It's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. The award-winning show Out of the Blocks is up next after the news at the top of the hour. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.